Hello and welcome to another episode of the We Have a Meeting podcast. So I'm incredibly excited for today's episode as we have an incredible guest, CIA officer turned serial entrepreneur. They've gone from military briefing rooms in jungles to corporate boardrooms and international stages. They're a CEO, a leadership consultant, a strategic advisor, coach and mentor. She now helps founders, leaders, and next generation change makers rewrite the rules of success and become unstoppable. Our guest today is Rupal Patel. Rupal, how are you?
Really good, Jack. Thank you for having me.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for joining us. I'm excited to kick off. I'll hit you with the question that we ask everybody.
Yeah.
Who are you and what problem do you solve?
Okay, gosh. So the who am I? It's a big one, but I'll give you sort of the high level bullet points. I'm a mother of two. I'm a founder of two businesses, speaker, author, and self-proclaimed nerd. So I love knowledge. I love learning about different things. And I firmly believe in using this one sort of go around I have on this planet to the best of my capabilities and doing and seeing and contributing as much as I possibly can.
Good answer. And if I was coming to one of your talks and I was sat in the audience, what kind of problems do you think I'd be looking to solve, or what kind of symptoms might I have that you might be able to help me with?
It's often the way I describe it is sort of a performance mindset. I think the problem I solve for, whether it's individuals or organizations or teams within an organization, is how to unlock their performance, how to oftentimes get out of their own way in pursuit of whatever is important, whether it's a strategic goal or a personal goal, an organizational goal, but effectively how to unlock that performance and the potential in each person.
Over to me. Hi, Rupal.
Hi, Seth.
So I'm so interested in the CIA component of your career. And from what I understand, people can come from all different backgrounds and end up in the CIA. So could you maybe give us a bit of background on what the events were that led up to it and how you ended up there in the first place?
Yeah. So I was in graduate school. I was studying to get a master's in international affairs and had actually never intended to work at the CIA. It wasn't part of my life's plan, such as it was back all those years ago. But when I was studying for this degree, someone from the CIA asked me if I would be interested in applying to the agency. And I just thought, well, this is not an invitation that I can easily say no to. So completely sort of on a whim, really, I said yes, and then met with that person a few days later just to talk about what kinds of roles I would be doing and what about my background and skills was of interest to them. And it just seemed like a perfect fit because they wanted me, well, like what I was hired, excuse me, as was an analyst. And again, it ticked all the right boxes for me, right? Getting really, really smart on particular issues, using that knowledge to help decision makers with U.S. foreign policy, and effectively being, again, paid to be a nerd and a lifelong learner. It seemed like the best job description I could have thought of.
And what are maybe some of the, I think me and Jack, who are civilians to this sort of stuff and probably ignorant to it, we hear CIA, MI6, we think James Bond.
Yeah.
So what are the misconceptions about what the reality actually is of working in the CIA?
Yeah, in some ways it is far sexier than what you would see in the films and movies. And my last year at the agency, I was given insight into our most top secret missions around the world. And I just remember thinking, being in these rooms where we were discussing these programs, thinking, oh my God, I could not in my wildest of dreams imagine something like this as possible. But in many ways, it's also a lot less sexy than you would think from the movies or Homeland or, you know, these shows that become really, really popular. So it's quite extreme. There are some real incredible things. Again, this idea that things are impossible doesn't really factor into the way the agency operates. And that was something that really I was suffused with while I was there. But some certain elements of it are also just like any other job, right? You have to have performance reviews, you have awkward conversations with bosses or teammates or colleagues that are a little bit difficult to work with. But for me, what made some of the more mundane things worth it was the overarching mission and the overarching sense of camaraderie that the agency does a really good job of fostering.
And when you fell into it, when you got into it to start with, did you know that you'd made the right choice? Was everything kind of sunshine and daffodils to start?
No, you know, I am the type of person who, I'm very intuitive in a lot of my decision making. And so I didn't know what to expect. I didn't go in with a lot of preconceived notions, aside from the movies, of what it would be or what it wouldn't be. And I just sort of let it be what it was and made the best of some of the things that I was frustrated with or wanted to do more of and found ways to advocate for myself. So it wasn't sunshine and roses for sure. There was a lot of throwing myself into the deep end, figuring things out, carving my own niche, because even though I was hired to be an analyst, the last thing I wanted to do was spend an entire career behind a desk at headquarters, right? You don't go to a place like the CIA and then just stay in DC your whole career. And so trying to find a way to use that analytical sort of label, but put me out in the field as much as possible was something that I was very intentional about doing. So I was able to, create a career for myself that ticked all the right boxes for me, while also, of course, ticking all the right boxes for the organization. But it was, it wasn't like it was a plan laid out for me, or it was easy from the get go. It was a negotiation of what I was experiencing and what I wanted to do more or less of, and then figuring out ways to make it work.
And it sounds like the person that said, "Have you ever thought about this?" They obviously saw something in you, some key attributes that they would probably associate with the CIA. Sounds like you might not have, to start with, might not have seen those attributes within yourself. What were some of those standout attributes that, with hindsight, you can look back and say, that's why I was a good fit?
I think, first of all, just my experience of living overseas, having sort of a broader awareness of the world, for sure. It also, I imagine, in some ways helps that I come from an immigrant background. So I have experienced sort of different cultures as a natural part of my life, as opposed to it sort of being something I had to learn in a more concrete way. I think language capability was always very attractive to them, just given the nature of our work. And so having some language capabilities myself probably was a good thing. And then I think this wouldn't necessarily come out on, sort of a CV, but in conversations with them, sort of intellectual curiosity, having a breadth of awareness about not just the world, but different elements of the world and different fields of endeavor and study. And I think also, and maybe this played less of a role because I was being hired as an analyst, but I imagine some of it is, the agency is a huge place and you can take your career in so many different directions, regardless of where you start. And I physically look like I could blend into a lot of different cultures. And I think that probably is an asset, depending on what I want to do with my career. So they never sort of gave me a checklist and said, well, these are the reasons that we hired you. But just intuitively, I think these are the things that make sense given the nature of the work that the agency does overall.
And that, you said intellectual curiosity. I'm guessing that's one of the key skills that you've got, that curiosity factor when it comes to transferring from CIA to CEO. What other transferable skills have you found now in your line of work that you're like, I learned that by doing this, and that my craft is this because I did this and I have that experience?
Yeah. So one of our unofficial mottos, and I, not for the whole organization, but for at least some of the teams that I worked with, was better to beg for forgiveness than ask for permission. And I think that sense of pushing the boundaries and testing the limits of what the done thing is and not settling for sort of established ways of doing things and having a bit more of a willingness to try things, that I guess in the UK, you'd probably say a bit of cheek, right? Having a little bit of just pushing the boundaries and seeing what you can get away with, right? Of course, in service of something important and bigger than just your own sort of ego. But I think that was a huge element, that that creativity, that not taking no for an answer, that that sense that you get to decide the when the fight is over and not necessarily just take what you're given for granted, but make it what you want. That all of that, I think sort of the way I would describe it is sort of an agile way of thinking and problem solving, having an expansive idea of what is possible, and then also resilience. And this isn't something that you can necessarily train in a in an individual, I think, but given the types of scenarios that we as an both an organization and I myself sort of volunteered to put myself into, you have to be willing to roll with the punches, right? Nothing will go as planned. Very little sort of is a straight line from A to B. And being able to pick yourself back up, figure out another way around or under or through a problem or a challenge, whether it's intellectual or physical, was something that, you know, I got a lot of practice doing, even though it wasn't like a formal, you know, formal part of the training.
I'm really interested to ask you about biases. So I imagine if you're in Afghanistan or you're looking at information from Afghanistan, you're synthesizing and analyzing all that information. There's a role that your emotions might want to get involved in some of the decision-making or some of the deciphering of information. So how do you make decisions that are objective rather than emotional when the stakes are so high?
Well, we were in a really lucky position as an organization that we actually don't make decisions. We don't decide policy. We inform policymakers. So our job was to be as objective as possible and not say what the superiors wanted to hear or what we thought they wanted to hear, but it was, this is what the data tells us. This is where the body of evidence is skewing, but also these are our blind spots. This is where we need to collect more intelligence, or this is some of the things that we don't really have enough information to make an educated assumption on. So it was being very clear about our role and not really straying far from it. Again, at least in my experience with the work that I did, it was inform policymakers with the best, most objective intelligence that you possibly can, leveraging the incredibly powerful brains that were, you know, sort of in the team. But once we send them that report or give them that briefing, what they do with it is totally out of our control. And that was really hard for me personally to handle, because I'm a doer, right? Like, I don't like just theory for theory's sake or ideas for their own sake. It's like, what are we going to do with this? And if this is what the evidence says, then the most logical thing would be to go with the evidence, right? And so for me, the politics of decision-making and policy-making was really challenging. But, you know, in some ways, it was also a huge relief that we didn't have that pressure to make the decisions and to write the policies, because we could just do what we did best. And then, you know, sort of leave it to those elected officials to decide what, you know, what they were going to do with that information.
So I suppose sticking on that then, if you were going to a briefing and you know, this is not news that people want to hear, this isn't the rosy story that they're hoping to hear, are there things that you've learned from doing that that have informed, if I've got to have a difficult conversation with someone, or rules that you found of this is the way to deliver bad news or certainly more critical news, tips that we could use that we could maybe share with the audience?
Yeah, definitely. So I talk a lot about this in my book, actually, where this whole idea of speaking truth to power. And that was one of our other unofficial mottos was, you know, we're not in the business of kowtowing to what policymakers want to hear or cherry picking the evidence to support what they want us to support. So we often were in a position where we had to say, well, actually, Mr. President or Mr. Senator, despite what you want or what you think or where the direction of this initiative is going, this is what the reality is on the ground based on, again, the body of evidence, et cetera, et cetera. And I myself had to do that in a very direct way, because when I served in a war zone, I was the civilian briefer to the commanding general. And, you know, he had his own intelligence from the military side of things. But because of the nature and, the politics within the military, it was often a little bit softly, oh, well, don't tell the boss what anything bad kind of thing. Whereas we came in not intentionally like bulls in a china shop, but the idea was, again, what I said, is sharing what the evidence suggests, what the best intelligence, what the best analysis is. And often it was or maybe not often, but there were times when it would contradict some of what he was hearing from his own people. So the way I navigated that was, again, first and foremost, know your stuff, right? So this is true for anyone having a difficult conversation. If you're going to give a message that you know the other person might respond adversely to or has some preconceived notions around, that it's going to challenge those, know your information. Like, what is the evidence, right? Don't just go in and sort of run off at the mouth saying, oh, well, this is what I think. Well, why do you think that, right? How can you support it? What was in our case, it was, this is the methodology. This is the reams of data and intelligence that we looked at. This is the process we went through, not just vetting the sources, but vetting our own analysis internally with other organizations, et cetera, et cetera. So know your stuff, go in super well prepared for why you can and how you can justify your argument and your position. And then secondly, and this is the other thing, because as all of us know, having the best argument doesn't mean it's the most convincing argument. And in order to convince the other person or to at least get them to see your side of things, which is often what we're having to do in these difficult conversations, is understand how they operate. Try to get in their minds. What do they care about? How do they receive information? What is really, really important to them? How can you adapt the language so it speaks their language instead of it, you know, being the same thing for everyone? And I think that element is so, so crucial, because it's not about you, right? It's about the other person. And we make it about us. We make it about the information. We make it about, well, this is the thing that's right. So, you know, just on the face of it, everyone should sort of agree and take it on board. That's not how human beings work, right? So we have to understand the other person and then adapt the message, not to change the message, but adapt the message so it's more likely to be received in the way that they need to receive it.
That was brilliant. I love that. You've referred to yourself a couple of times throughout the conversation as a nerd. What do you mean by that?
I love understanding things. I think I've always, again, been very intellectually curious. This was, you know, not just from the agency, but as a, you know, I've always loved reading. I've loved to understand how things work, how people work, how the world works. I just have that sort of analytical bent of mind. And I think for me, the worst thing that I could do is to stop learning. And I do believe sometimes in just learning for learning's sake. Who knows how you'll use the information? Maybe you do, maybe you don't. But I'm not that sort of, what's the word I'm looking for? I'm not overly principled about it, right? It's some, for me, learning is just fun. It's challenging myself intellectually, challenging myself mentally. But more often than not, what happens is when I do go down these sort of rabbit holes of just learning more about the way things are in different fields, whether it's astrophysics or, you know, Renaissance art or whatever it is, you can draw parallel lessons and insights from any field of human endeavor and bring it into a way that is tangible in your day-to-day life. And that's a lot of what I did in my book, was exactly that. You know, the CIA, very few people are going to have the experience of working at the CIA or even necessarily starting their own businesses. But in that process for me, what did I learn and what are the transferable things that would be relevant in anyone's sort of day-to-day life or career? And that's something that I love doing. You know, for me, it is just, again, that thing of, I've only got this one life. I want to make sure that I am using it in the best way that I have defined would be the best way for me. So learning is a huge part of that.
And you talk a lot about like embracing the weirdness within. Yeah. I think like, so what did that look like before you embraced it? And what have you found from leaning into it more?
Gosh. So I have felt like an outsider for, I would say, large majorities of my life. So I'm in my 40s now, early 40s, and I probably didn't really feel properly comfortable in my skin and who I am and all of my quirks and weirdnesses or what I thought others would view as weird until well into my 30s, right? So this was not something that I just one day woke up and it's like everything is all sunshine and roses. It was a process. And I think some of it just came from age and maturity and life experience. And also a lot of it came from paying attention as I was going and growing and evolving and doing different things in my life and career. I realized that actually everybody is sort of off and odd in some way, right? But the problem is that we're all given, and this is universal, right? We're all given archetypes of what certain people look like, of what a leader looks like, or what, you know, the ideal woman or the ideal man, or what a nerd looks like, or what, you know, all of these things. And some of it, a lot of it is often informed from the media and from movies and that kind of thing. And we all come to life with this baggage that's sort of, we're just immersed in, right? All of this noise around what things are supposed to look like and what human beings are supposed to be like. And, you know, if I say the word accountant or fashion designer or artist, all of us will immediately conjure up images, right? And I am all of those things to different degrees, not professionally, right? But I've worn many, many different hats and identified in many, many different ways over time. But because it wasn't neat, because it was, you know, I'm an athlete and a scholar. I'm very American, but I'm also traditional in some ways. There were many things that felt like opposites instead of just the reality, which is true for all of us. We're all complex beings with many layers. And so I got to a point, and it wasn't, again, it wasn't like an overnight, one day I woke up and I was like, I'm just going to love who I am and accept all of my rough edges and whatever. It was an evolution, because it fundamentally, and again, I think some of this turning inwards happened as I made that big transition from leaving the CIA and having the safety and security of an organization and an infrastructure and an identity into throwing myself into the unknown when I started my own businesses. All of a sudden I was a nobody, right? I didn't have a title. I didn't have a company that I could point to. I didn't have much of a way of describing myself in the way we all describe ourselves based on, you know, where we work, what we do, that kind of thing. I was in the process of building it. And that really shook up this sense of like, well, who the hell am I, right? I'm not a student anymore. I'm not a CIA officer anymore. I'm not all of these things that I had identified with. And it really forced me to grapple with all of that baggage, all of that sense of belonging or not belonging. And I realized, again, went with the benefit of hindsight and reflection, that all of that stuff was not, some of it was just in my own head. Some of it, of course, is imposed on us in the way people treat us. But I just decided I was done with that. I wasn't going to let myself be saddled by that anymore. And then I did the work to actually go from realizing I wanted to embrace my weirdness and my complexity to actually learning how to do that, teaching myself how to do that for myself. And sadly, I do think some of it does just come from age and experience and maturity, but there are ways to, I think, to accelerate that process if it's something that you want to invest in. But too few of us spend the or invest the time to do it. But it's, you know, for me, it's been 100% worth it.
Amazing. For those who haven't seen your TED Talk,
yeah,
there's probably people who want to know where your confidence came from, how they can build confidence themselves. Mm-hmm. So there's probably people who know that are listening to this, that they need to push themselves in a certain direction in order to start achieving whatever they're putting their mind to. So what advice can you give someone about how to build confidence, where to start, what you did?
So there are two things, but first I just want to go back and just put out there that I would never have described myself as a confident person. I actually was very self-conscious and very unconfident for a good at least half of my life. And the confidence that I developed, so going to now what others can do who want to develop it, it's a few things. One, for me, confidence has to come from something, right? For me, confidence comes from competence, developing a competence, getting really good at something so you can justifiably be confident about that thing, right? I think blind confidence, if you can't back it up, I mean, it's not sustainable, right? So I think fundamentally you have to be good at something to help part of that process of developing your inner confidence. So the competence is key. Secondly, it's being willing to try and to just get over ourselves of what it means when things don't go our way or when we fail at something or whatever. You just gotta be a trier. And that process of trying and sometimes getting what you want, trying and maybe oftentimes not getting what you want, but continuing to go and keep going and try different ways. Again, that resilience and that agility of like, okay, well, this didn't work. I'm going to try it this way. Until you are successful, that is a huge way of training your confidence muscle. I think most things in life, the sort of what we often refer to as soft skills, especially when it comes to sort of the head games that we play on ourselves, all of these things can be learned, right? No, I was not born a confident person. I learned how to, you know, I developed confidence over time and experience. So whether you feel you are or you're not is irrelevant. If you want to develop your confidence, you can. So if, again, like I said, develop your competence, practice, right? Try different things and push yourself in ways that you might not have done, and continue to keep going even when things aren't, you're not getting the results you want. And related to that is this idea of, you know, when you have a setback, you can make it about yourself, or you can just make it an objective thing. It's an objective thing. It's not personal. It's not, oh, well, I didn't get this. I didn't close this sale, or I didn't get this customer, or I didn't do whatever. Oh, I am a failure. No, that situation didn't work out the way you wanted, but it doesn't mean you suck as a human being. It just means them's the breaks, right? As all of us will know, and as you both probably know for yourselves as well, most things in life are a numbers game, right? You gotta be willing to put in the hours and the effort and keep going and keep trying and keep failing and keep going until you get that little bit of success, and then the momentum builds, and then it builds, and then it builds, and then it becomes easier. But you have to take away this stigma of, and take away this idea of personalizing and internalizing everything that happens, because it's not about you. It really isn't about you, right? You might have caught someone on a bad day, or they might not have the budget for what you're selling, or maybe the product is the wrong thing for them in their lives at that time. You know, there are millions of different things that could be going on as to why you were rejected or someone said no to you. Who cares? This, again, get over yourself and just keep going, because that really is where you will see what you are made of, how you can, again, continue to sort of pick yourself back up, and how much you actually want that thing. And so the last thing I would say about developing confidence, and it's a little bit cheesy, but it's to be very clear about your why, about your purpose, about why it is you're pursuing whatever it is that you are. Because all of those knocks, if your why isn't big enough, then it will give you an excuse to just quit when things get tough. But for me, I have decided that for my sort of North Star is I want to make as big a positive impact on this world and the people in it while I'm on this earth. So every time I get a rejection, every time something gets a little bit tricky and I'm like, oh, well, maybe I should just quit trying. Maybe it's not worth the effort. I say, you know what? Actually, well, it's not about me, right? It's about all those other things, about the bigger purpose that I want to serve. So in order to do that, again, I have to get over myself and my hangups and my, oh, I can't do this, and this is so hard, and all that whininess in our heads, and just keep going. And then you do what you can, right? And that, I think there's a certain inner confidence that comes from just accepting that regardless of the results, at least you did what you could.
So your analytical skills then, your analytical skills, and probably I would think I'm making a character judgment here, hopefully not an offensive one, but I would think that that's probably the way you're maybe naturally wired to be more analytical about information and yeah, how life's working around you. But yeah, then also you've had to be spontaneous and push yourself out of your comfort zone. Is the analytical part of your mind at war with that part, or do they work quite nicely together?
They work really nicely together. And I think, again, it's that thing that we often tell ourselves, we're either left-brained or we're right-brained. And, you know, so many times when I take personality tests, I'm just like this weird blob, right? I'm sort of halfway in the middle of everything. So who cares, right? It doesn't have to be attention. And if anything, there's some really beautiful cross-pollination, because part of what allows me to be creative and spontaneous is this body of knowledge and having thought about things in a certain way. And then in the moment, things will just start to click, and vice versa. You know, you can bring creativity to analysis and say, actually, well, this is one way of looking at that problem and breaking it down, but actually here's another way of looking at it. So I think they're mutually beneficial. It doesn't have to be either or. I have never felt them to be in conflict. And maybe that's just because I've always had to live with these two powerful sides of I guess, who I am and my temperament. But again, we don't have to be so black or white about things. I think we can often get really stuck in labels and boxes about, well, I'm either this or I'm that. Well, you can be, all of us are a little bit of pretty much everything. So you can make it work.
I love, you said earlier about confidence comes with competence, which I think is, I've never heard that. I think that's amazing. I like to think it, sometimes the analogy, especially when we're training new people in sales and communication and things like that, I give the analogy of, if I went and told you to go and build a house, how confident would you feel on a scale of 1 to 10? if you've never built a house before, you probably wouldn't feel confident because you've not done it. But if you've done it 10 times and people have lived in those houses for years and no one's died and it's not fallen over, you'll probably feel a lot more confident. And I've got an analogy called the evidence shelf. So an imaginary shelf behind me that's stacked with evidence that says, actually, you can do this and you can do it time and time again because you've got that evidence. So do you have anything anecdotally where that what's on your evidence shelf where that self-doubt and that voice might creep in, where in the boardroom or meeting with decision makers or meeting with these incredible companies you work with? Yeah. And have you got anything anecdotally where you say, no, actually, because I've done this, this and this, I know I can achieve that?
Yes and no. So to some extent, yes. What I've done is over time, and I did this actually even when I was back at the agency, I keep track of all of the positive feedback, performance reviews, anecdotal sort of conversations with people where they've given me feedback on my performance in some way. So when I am having those moments of self-doubt, I can just go to what I refer to as my brag sheet and say, oh, actually, you don't suck at life. Look, these are all of the people who think you did a great job in X, Y, or Z way, right? And I think sometimes when you talk about the evidence shelf, we are wired to look for negative data and negative information. So we'll remember all of the times that we failed. We'll remember all of the times that someone said something snarky or horrible or put us down. But when it comes time to remembering the good stuff, we somehow just get amnesia in the moment. And I think, you know, again, there is an evolutionary reason for it, but it's not particularly helpful. And so to counter that, and because I know I'm someone who responds very deeply to feedback, I've made a point of making sure that I keep track of these things so that I can pick myself up as and when I need to, you know, if I'm going through sort of a down period, emotionally or mentally. But as far as sort of going into unexpected things and having just like, again, the confidence to go in and be like, yeah, I'm going to nail this. I mean, at this point, it's less about just feeling confident in everything. It's more about just knowing what I'm there to do and not psyching myself up about everything else going on, right? So I don't make a habit of claiming to do things, or I don't do it at all, claim to do things that I can't do, right? So I'm never going to be in a position where I'm like, oh my God, how did I get, roped into doing this project or working with this client because I'm just, you know, in over my head right now. I wouldn't do that to myself. It's not going to serve anyone to just sort of throw myself in it. What I am very good at doing is in every context I'm in, knowing and being very conscious of in some of the preparation, but also in the moment of what value am I adding to this room? Sometimes that value is technical, sometimes it's analytical, sometimes it's emotional, intellectual. It's different things in different contexts. So unless I am just feeling a bit self-destructive and I'm like, yeah, I can do this thing that I've never tried before. Yeah, I'm going to, I don't know, apply to be the head of NASA or whatever. It's something I have no training or ability in. I don't worry too much about whether or not I can do it because I know what I'm good at. I try to do those things. And yes, I expand that and I stretch that, but I'm not going to pretend I'm someone I'm not just to see what it feels like.
I love it. And I love the idea of a brag sheet. Is that an actual literal brag sheet that you could...
No, I mean, unofficially, that's what I called it. I mean, I've heard people refer to similar concepts as like a smile file or a trophy chest or, you know, but for me, that's what I called it way back when I started at the CIA. So that's what I'm sticking with.
I like it. It's good. And in the, obviously, as the CEO, I'm guessing there has been many opportunities when meeting with new people that may have a desire for your services, and that would have involved the selling process. A lot of people that listen to our podcast are people that work in sales or they're entrepreneurs and things like that. What have you found to be important when meeting new people and selling yourself / your service?
Yeah. So it's being very honest about what you can do for them, what you can't do for them, and understanding what it is they need, right? Because it goes back to that thing about, and sometimes actually sales can be really difficult, awkward conversations. So earlier when we were talking about having difficult conversations, it's getting into their head. It's not just about, okay, well, I know I've got the best product or service or whatever for you, and you should just, you know, on the strength of that, you know, accept it and take it. It's, well, what do you need? What are your challenges? And sometimes what people on the other side tell you their challenges or their problems are, aren't actually what it is. So being able to ask good questions, understanding what's going on in their heads, and also understanding how their organization works, because they might not be the final decision maker. They might just be the initial gatekeeper. So, you know, what is the process? And I think initial conversations, and you probably do this a lot in your training, is asking really good questions. Because we go in and make so many assumptions about what they need, what they want, who this person is, their authority, their ability to say yes or no. And sometimes we get it totally wrong. So do your homework, understand, you know, what's going on in that scenario, get as much information as you possibly can instead of talking all the time. And then when you have tangible insights into the reality of that organization or how that, you know, situation or how that, yeah, how that company operates, then you can determine, well, do I have a solution for you or do I not? And you can be very honest about all of those things, because otherwise you're going to be talking at each other as opposed to trying to figure out how this is going to work and whether or not you have a solution that is going to solve their problems. So yeah, I would say, especially those first initial meetings, make it a bit of a fact-finding meeting, do a lot less talking than you do listening, ask really good questions, come prepared with a list of really good questions. I think so many times people think that these, again, these quote unquote soft skills are just, you have a really good intuition for sales and a really good intuition for the close. You have to prepare for this stuff. You can develop an intuition over time, but you have to prepare. Don't just go in and wing it. I mean, if you want to do a good job and if you genuinely want to serve that person on the other side of the table, you have to do your homework. So do your homework. Again, be very clear about what you can and cannot offer, and then have, at least in the first instance, a really open conversation where you ask really good questions.
Amazing. It's like you're singing from the same hymn sheet.
Yeah.
So I feel like we could probably talk to you all day. There's a last question. I feel like we asked this on a few different podcasts, and you're probably the best person so far to give us a real answer to this.
Okay.
Is it possible to persuade someone?
I have a slightly different... So yes is the short answer. The long answer is, I think sometimes we think of persuasion as getting them to say yes. But what sometimes is more helpful is making it really hard for them to say no. Because if you go in with a great proposition and you've done all of your homework, you've done all of those things, we assume that, like, when it's so obvious that it should just be like, yeah, slam dunk, they're going to go for it and we're going to close this thing right now, right? The reality is, again, it's a process. And sometimes the way you sort of seed that final yes is by just taking away all of the reasons for them to say no. So I think it's a bit of a dance between persuading and also, what's the right word for it? Sort of planting the argument so that they come to it a bit more naturally. And all of those, again, those objections are taken away before you get to that final conversation about, are we doing this or not? So yeah, it's not always about getting the yes. Sometimes it's about making it really hard for them to say no. And as both of you will know, it's the exact same principles apply with kids, right? So it's like all of those negotiations we're doing with our kids around bedtime and eating and whatever else it is, they're never going to be like, yes, I 100% want to go to bed when you tell me. It's about, well, do you want to be tired tomorrow? No. Do you want to wake up cranky? No. You know, and that, I think that can be a really helpful tool in thinking about persuasion a little bit differently.
You make a very good point. If the technique won't work on my 3-year old trying to get him to go to bed, it's not going to work on a grown up either. We're all 3-year olds deep down still. Wonderful. So I suppose if someone's watching this, they want to pick up your book, they want to find out more about you, how would they start all of those different processes?
Yeah, so it's very easy. My book is available everywhere. So Amazon, Waterstones, all of your major booksellers around the world. So yes, please go buy it and leave a review if you can. It's called From CIA to CEO. So hopefully it's a memorable enough title. And then if they want to get in touch with me directly, it's also very straightforward. They can just go to my website, which is rupalypatel.com. There you go.
Perfect. Perfect. We'll put all that in the description. Great. Thank you so much. I've really, really enjoyed this.
It's been my pleasure.
Thank you so much.